I reminded Chris that I preached on this passage in the evening service back in 2013. But as I can't remember what I said, I'm fairly confident that no one else who heard it will remember it either. So my name's Janet Quarry, and I work down the road in Cowley at the Church Mission Society. And the thing most relevant about my work to this topic today is that I help to lead the Security Working Group, which I may have spoken about before up here. And this working group strives to make sure that we are ready for the right response in the event of kidnap, imprisonment, illness, or maybe death, for example, of any of our mission personnel. I can't just say we'll pray about it. We do actually have to show, as an organization, that we have a duty of care to our people. And if one of our mission personnel were to be imprisoned, and it does happen, not CMS, thank you, Lord, recently, but it does happen, and it has happened to many agencies. If the family were to come to us and say to us, what are you doing about it? It wouldn't go down too well if all we said was, well, we've called a prayer meeting. But on the other hand, if the family are Christian, it would go down equally badly if we were to admit that we weren't praying at all. One of the other things that I do now is a session with all our new mission partners on the theology of risk. And this passage is quite pertinent to that discussion, but we won't have a seminar on the theology of risk now, you'll be pleased to hear. So, just to say, too, I think the last twice that I've preached here, I left my PowerPoint behind at work. So this time, I prepared it at home, so there's no chance of doing that. And it's all ready, and it's on the disc, and it's in the handbag. And when I parked my car, I went to put my keys in my handbag. And I've left my handbag at home. So I think God is saying to you, you don't have to have a PowerPoint to be able to integrate, you know, interact with a service, because there isn't one. So the thing I wanted, and actually it was only two slides, and I thought it would be helpful to actually see it, but you'll just have to see it in your head now. I wanted to remind us of the historical context of the passage that we're looking at, because the very first person, I did actually remember my Bible, that's good, the very first person mentioned in this passage is King Herod. And so I thought it would be just important for us to remind ourselves of the different Herods. Herod the Great was the one who tried to murder Jesus as a baby, and he slaughtered all the boy children in the attempt, and that we read about in Matthew 2. Herod the Great, I think there is a reason why he was called the Great, but anyway, Herod the Great had five wives. Perhaps that's why he was considered great. He had five wives, and one of his sons was Herod Antipas. And it's that Herod who killed John the Baptist, and that is in Matthew 14. This is the very complicated bit. That Herod Antipas had a brother and a sister who got it together and had a child. And that child was Herod Agrippa, and that is this Herod in this passage. So his grandfather was Herod the Great, and he was a nephew of Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa. And just to finish off the Herods, that Herod, this Herod in this chapter, had a son as well, and that he became Herod Agrippa the Second, and it's that Herod who investigated Paul in Acts 25 and 26. Okay, so you didn't need a PowerPoint for that, did you? So now just to put it into the date, Herod the Great attempted to murder Jesus around AD 0 to 4 AD. It has to be before then because Herod the Great died in 4 AD. Herod Antipas divorced his wife and married his niece. They were a really nice family, weren't they? He divorced his wife, married his niece, and it was the niece, remember, who asked for the head of John the Baptist. That was around 31 AD. And Herod Agrippa, this one in chapter 12, he would have put Peter in prison around AD 40, 7 years after the death of Christ. has to be around then, because Herod Agrippa, we know, died in AD 44. So it's absolutely put there in a historical context. And if you've got Bibles, and you can see just a few sentences before in Acts 11, a prophet called Agabus stood up and predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. Well, again, we know the dates of Claudius. And he was emperor from 41 to 54 AD. So again, we can know that Peter was put in prison around 40 AD, because Claudius wasn't yet emperor, according to these verses. And then, again, just to finish them off, Herod Agrippa II investigated Paul around 60 AD, and we would say that because it's known that Paul probably died in the Nero persecutions in 66 AD, along with Peter, actually. So that's the first bit of timing, and there's a second bit of timing in the passage, because it says that Herod Antipas, the second Herod, Herod Agrippa, get it right, I've written it down wrong. Herod Agrippa put Peter in prison during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And he planned to keep him there until after the Passover. Now, if you do what I did and go and look in Leviticus and Numbers and all the rest and actually read about these things, you'll find actually that Passover happened first, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread happened for 7 days. And yet our text here says he planned to keep him there until after the Passover. So is he there for a year, you know, waiting for the next Passover to come round? What's going on? Well, I think Luke is using the shorthand here, and he's encompassing the whole of the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread into what you would call Passover. So Passover happened, and then remember back in Exodus, the Jews had to escape and they couldn't wait around to make proper bread. They had to grab and run with unleavened bread. So they remembered that feast for 7 days. But the whole thing came to be called Passover. Now, you may or may not know that there's one of the debates that rage is whether Luke was a Gentile or not. I don't know whether you rage about that and care about it or not. Either he was a Jew or he was a Gentile. So maybe he was a Jew and so familiar with the feast that he didn't bother to explain it carefully. Or else he was a Gentile and didn't really understand the significance of it all and so didn't explain it properly. Being a Gentile myself, I like to think he was a Gentile, but you can really decide for yourself and argue it either way. Anyway, it seems Peter was kept in prison for at least 2 to 3 days, probably longer, because we don't know how long after the feast that Herod decided to have a show trial and actually put Peter to death, if at all possible. We need to remember, too, as we come to this passage, that this is now the third time that Peter has been in prison. So in Acts 4, he was put in prison overnight. And afterwards, he had the opportunity to preach a great sermon when he mentioned Psalm 118:22. The stone the builders have rejected have become the capstone. He develops that sermon even more in his first letter, 1 Peter 2. So it's a passage and an illustration that Peter was very fond of, not least, I'm sure, because it was Jesus, of course, who called him Peter, Petros, the rock. Remember in Acts 4, the Jewish leaders took note that these were ordinary, unschooled men who had been with Jesus. This was the first imprisonment, and he was released by the authorities. And they said, stop preaching, but he went back into the courtyards and straight away carried on preaching. Then in Acts 5, it says several of the apostles were imprisoned, but during the night, an angel opened the door and led them out. It's very similar to our passage today. But that time, they went straight back out again and carried on preaching in the temple courts. It doesn't actually say Peter was imprisoned with them, but it's implied because he was standing with them saying, we must obey God rather than human beings. Something, however, has changed between chapter 5 and our passage now in chapter 12. First of all, there's the stoning of Stephen. One of the leaders in the church has been killed. Someone has died. And secondly, a wave of persecution has begun, headed up by a young zealot called Saul, who was going from house to house and dragging people off to prison, and they were not being rescued by angels. Families torn apart, children going hungry, and all the rest. And thirdly, right at the beginning of this passage, James, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, one of the 12 apostles, has been arrested and killed. Something has changed. Now no one is safe. No one is protected. And Peter himself is thrown into prison, awaiting trial and probable execution. He's guarded by 16 men, who probably did it in four-hour slots together. And there he is in prison, waiting. Time of extreme stress, I would suggest. Now, when I preached on this passage in 2013, Chris gave me the title of Knock and the Door Shall Be Opened. I don't know if you remember, it's in the computer. But this time he's given me the title of The Great Escape. And that title, of course, made me go to the film of the same name, The Great Escape. It was made back in 1963. Did they really make good films back then? Yes. I take it most people have seen it. How many people have not seen The Great Escape? Oh, dear, 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 dear. We might have to have a showing of this one evening. So we're going to look at a little bit of it if we can, because I did remember to bring the DVD. The film was based on a camp called Stalag Luftwaffe 3. The Germans collected together all the airmen who would persist in trying to escape. And as the film says, they put all their bad eggs in one basket. So I thought we ought to watch a bit of the film, if we can get it to work. Now, I seem to remember the last time I showed a bit of film, it was Harrison Ford in a sewer, and all you could see was kind of bits of dark and not much else. And of course, this is like they dug their way out, so this is a tunnel. So again, I'm afraid it's quite a lot of, you may see nothing but pitch black if they can get it to work. So they, while they're trying, I'll just carry on, they dug three tunnels. One of the tunnels was discovered. They were hugely long, about 300 meters long, they dug these tunnels. And out of the second tunnel, they called them Tom, Dick, and Harry, and out of the second tunnel, 76 men escaped. Now, unfortunately, they didn't do their surveying quite right. Of course, they had to do it all under the auspices of being watched by so on. And the tunnel stopped 20 foot short of the wood. So there's all the guards actually watching the camp, not the wood, but, you know, and they're trying to get out and get into the wood. In full view, possibly. Thankfully, they had Steve McQueen to rescue them. So he sat in the wood and he tugged on a rope when the guards weren't looking, so they knew when to come out of the tunnel. And here we are. I wanted to show also the iconic bit of Steve McQueen on his motorbike, but again, we might show it after when we're watching coffee. Anyway, enough of this. What I wanted to do, the reason for showing that, was to set up a comparison between that film and so many others like them and our passage today. So here in this film, we have a group of incredibly brave and inventive young men fighting a system, putting all of their ingenuity and their intelligence and their bravery into the building of the tunnels, making the escape clothes, forging the papers, gathering the food to take with them, making the tools to dig, getting rid of the dirt, and so on and so on and so on. It was a massive, massive undertaking. They aimed to get 270 men out. I mean, astonishing. They only got 76 out in the end, but amazing. Contrast that with Peter. On his own, chained, naked, between two guards, and guarded by 14 others, in the dark. Asleep. Asleep. His friends were meeting together to pray earnestly for him. What do you suppose they prayed? What would you have prayed? What would you have prayed? For justice, for strength in adversity, for his release maybe, for that he is enabled to be witness in the situation, for, maybe for his life. Perhaps they just prayed that he'd be able to sleep. Never assume that your prayers just go off into the ether and aren't heard by God. Throughout the 80s, I and others prayed earnestly at college where I was then for those who were political prisoners behind the Iron Curtain. And eventually we saw that curtain come down. But there are many, many people imprisoned for their faith today. Many, many more than at any time in history. Do we ever stop to find out about them and to pray for them? And I've asked Chris if maybe we could do so during our communion. Peter's on his own. He's chained. And Paul in chapter 16 was praying and was singing with Silas. But you know, Peter, sometimes it's okay to sleep. You don't always have to be singing under adversity. He was obviously at peace with himself, his emotions, and with God. He was able to leave his fears and his discomfort and compose himself to sleep. And then something happens. A light shone in the jail, a person arrived, the chains fell from his wrists and probably ankles. The person wakes him, but not the guards. Clothes are provided, maybe his own clothes were there, and he's led out of the jail. Now, Brother Yun tells a similar story. I don't know if you've read this book. How many have read this book? It's a wonderful story of a Chinese person imprisoned by the authorities in China, and he describes something very similar. In a maximum security jail, one day he felt God, knew God was saying to him, "Today is the day you should escape." And he walked out in full view of the guards. There's more to the story than that. We won't go into it. I was tempted to read it and go, "Nah, he's making that up. He's making that up." Except that I've met people who have met Brother Yun. And I know he's an honorable man. So I choose to believe. I believe God can do these things. I also believe in angels. I've heard missionaries talk about such things. So why shouldn't it have happened here in Acts? Peter, when he was released, he went home to the home of John Mark. And in the next chapter, remember John Mark goes with Paul and Barnabas on the beginning of their first missionary journey. They would have had plenty of time as they walked for John Mark to say, "This, do you know, he knocked at the door. He was knocking at the door, and we didn't believe it. We just carried on." It must have been such a joke in the early church. You know, there we were praying for his release, and he was knocking at the door, and we just didn't believe it. One other thing to note, although Peter fades from the story of the book of Acts now, we know he didn't die for another 20 years. The Bible doesn't tell us how he died. Tradition tells us that this man who denied Jesus in the courtyard went on to be one of the bravest of men who eventually died in Rome. And it's worth reading the two letters that he wrote with that in mind. Of the 76 men who escaped from Stalag Luftwaffe 3, only three made it home to safety. Just three. Around 12 were sent back to the camp. Maybe around 14, up to 14, died in the escape attempt. And 50 were murdered by the Gestapo. They were just taken to a hillside and mowed down. And the film is made in memory of those men. So actually, in terms of escaping, it wasn't that successful, was it? That fact, it could be classified as a complete disaster. On the other hand, umpteen thousand Germans had to be deployed to recapture them, so diverting them for the war effort. We might want to take some time to think about what does success look like? Sometimes God sends his angels to surround us and protect us, and sometimes he doesn't. I wish God always protected me from pain and from struggle and darkness, but he doesn't. But I do know he's always there. Never doubt that. Peter's miraculously rescued, not by his own efforts, not by his own ingenuity, but by the direct intervention of God. In other passages, God's people die. How I hope and pray that my life measures up to Peter's, able to trust God for my future no matter what, life throws at me. Well, just to finish quickly, the passage is about two different doors, isn't it? The door that's shutting him in that God throws wide open, and the door of the house that he's knocking on. Why didn't God just throw that one open as well? But he didn't. He had to stay knocking on the door. And I wonder if there's a door that you are knocking on currently, a door closed that you want to be opened. What to do next in your life, a door for your children, your friends, whatever. You know, sometimes you have to wait and be patient. I'm sorry, I know that's not what we want to hear, but sometimes, even when we're desperate for something, sometimes we have to wait for God's timing. But keep knocking, just as Peter kept knocking, and the door will be opened. Perhaps there are prisons that you find yourselves in, prisons of current circumstances, prisons of past behavior and its consequences, prisons of past events that have damaged and scarred you, prisons of future fears or longings. Jesus can set us free. Not from the circumstance itself necessarily, but definitely from the mental, emotional, or spiritual prison it might have become. And there's one other door I want to mention before we go into communion. And that comes in Revelation 3:20. Jesus says, "Here I am, I stand at the door, and I knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, prays that prayer that we worked on earlier, I will come in and eat with them, and they with me." If we open the door of our hearts, he will come in and he will eat with us. So in a moment, we're going to come together and eat bread and wine. And Jesus said, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name." I don't know what we are here, 50, 60 or so. Gathering in his name. When we come to eat, let's bring to him in this communion service the doors that are shut in our lives and that we want him to fling open. And let's open the door of our hearts and let him come in. Amen.